listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at a new mandate from the Trump administration that rolls back coverage requirements for birth control. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news with a big Wisconsin redistricting case in the U.S. Supreme Court and a change of plans on I-94. Patrick Marley is a state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Patrick, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, you were at the U.S. Supreme Court covering this hearing, the oral arguments on a challenge to Wisconsin's election map. Remind us, what are plaintiffs arguing when it comes to redistricting here in Wisconsin?
So the Republican legislators had both houses of the when they drew these maps. They drew them to their favor, and so a group of Democratic voters said that they believed their constitutional rights were violated by those maps. A lower court agreed with them. Now the U.S. Supreme Court is reviewing whether the Republicans went too far in taking partisanship into account in drawing those maps.
And what's the state's argument then in response?
The state's argument is that this is the sole province of the legislature. They can draw the maps as they see fit. And also they contend that the state has a natural benefit to Republicans because Democrats tend to live in places like Madison and Milwaukee and have packed themselves into a small geographical area that gives a natural upside to Republicans when drawing statewide maps.
So the big thing on a Supreme Court case is listening to what the justices are saying and asking and trying to divine where they're going to go with this. What kind of things did you see from the justices in this case?
It seems pretty clear to me that we're going to get a 5-4 decision out of this case. The question is it going to be 5-4 for the state or is it going to be 5-4 for the Democratic voters? The swing vote there is Anthony Kennedy. That is one of the few points that all sides will agree on, is that he is the person who will determine the outcome of this case.
So the liberal justices, as they're usually described, the four of them, were sympathetic with the challenge to the map, and the conservative justices were not.
That's right. The conservative justices would, Samuel Alito said, this kind of move may be distasteful, but the courts can't really have a reliable standard for figuring out when things go too far. The courts have ruled in the past that politicians are allowed to consider partisanship and draw things to their advantage to some extent. They've also ruled that it can go too far and reaches a point at which it's done so extremely that it violates the Constitution. What the court has been divided with for decades is there a line you can draw that courts can manage in an easy way? And they have split on that. Anthony Kennedy has said, I do believe that we have not yet found a measurement to do it, but that there may be a measurement out there that courts could use to figure this out. And so this case proposes a new test. And the plaintiffs are hoping that Anthony Kennedy will agree with them that that's the way to figure out when things have gone too far.
And it seems like, in a way, this whole court case, as it's gone through the system, is basically targeted at one person, Justice Anthony Kennedy, and he's the one who's going to decide this.
That's right. I mean, everybody's pitching their arguments to him the other day. The briefs were written citing him as often as possible because they know he is the crucial vote here.
And did he do anything that might give any kind of tea leaf readers a glimmer into what he's thinking?
So I think anybody would caution you not to read too much into what they do on the bench, that sometimes somebody can give a hard time of one side and then end up being on their side in the end. But many took note of the fact that Anthony Kennedy had tough questions for the state and the legislators who drew these maps, but did not ask a single question of the attorney for the Democratic voters who are challenging the map.
We're talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, looking at some of the top news around Wisconsin this week. Want to move on? We'll be watching for that result from the Supreme Court. It'll be coming down. It'll take a while, I think. But I want to get a little closer to home now. A big change in plans for a stretch of I-94 in Milwaukee. State Transportation Secretary David Ross wrote to the feds, asking them to call off their authorization of a big expansion project. What would this project, Patrick, have done?
This is the stretch of road between the Zoo Interchange and the Marquette Interchange in Milwaukee. They're the two busiest interchanges on the state's freeway system. The state has long planned to build out that road. It's very old, and people describe it as a bit of a choke point. As the zoo interchange project gets near completion, you'll have four lanes of travel in each direction there, four lanes of travel in each direction at the Marquette interchange, and then it goes down to three lanes through this, what they call I-94 East-West. It's going to be a project that would cost almost $1 billion, probably more by the time the state would get around doing it. And what we learned was that the federal government had written a letter to the state, which has had trouble funding all its projects, saying that the state needed to come up with a funding plan by the end of September, or that it would revoke its authorization for it. Secretary Dave Ross's response to that was to write a letter of his own back to the Fed saying, we don't want the federal approval anymore. Please revoke that.
So this is a casualty in a way of the budget process and that long debate over transportation funding. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. The budget was delayed by almost 3 months, largely because lawmakers couldn't agree on what the appropriate funding levels were for transportation. They reached a compromise in which they didn't raise taxes, and they limited their borrowing. And, yeah, this is a direct outcome of that, with less money available for roads, we're going to see projects that are not just delayed, but delayed to such an extent that they're effectively abandoned.
Now, this stretch of highway you've written was not universally approved by people in the Milwaukee area. What kind of opposition did we see to it?
Yeah, the neighborhood there did not want this project to happen, was worried about the expansion. It goes through a historic neighborhood, Story Hill. It comes very close to two cemeteries. There was a lot of concern about that from the community. So this transportation funding issue has been an internal Republican fight, but the biggest victors here are the people in that neighborhood, the Democratic elected officials from Milwaukee, and Democrats and environmentalists generally who were opposed to that particular project.
So local Democratic officials were opposed to this?
Yes, many of them were.
And I want to, this bleeds into another news story a little bit. The Foxconn plant, there was talk about what kind of road changes, what kind of transportation funding would go into feeding into this proposed Foxconn plant. Is there spillover from this story into that one?
Well, maybe a little bit. I mean, one issue was that, I-94 south of Milwaukee, sort of through Racine County, has been a long neglected project. There was a debate over whether to do that or the zoo interchange first. The Doyle and Walker administrations disagreed on that, and the north-south leg of I-94 has been pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. Now with Foxconn coming, that project suddenly moved up to the front burner and was one of the few projects that got a big infusion of cash through the state budget, actually through the separate incentive package that was given to Foxconn. So that is now moved up in its priority, and you know, we should see a lot happening there in Racine County because of Foxconn.
And one more story I wanted to look at. Assembly Representative Bob Gannon, Republican from West Bend, passed away this week. Emergency responders had found him in his car. Initial reports say he died there of natural causes. How are fellow lawmakers and others in state government remembering him?
Well, he was not in the legislature for a long time, but he made a big impression here. He was a very conservative member of the legislature with very strong opinions and someone who was not afraid to state them. So he was cheered by his conservative colleagues as someone who was a principled voice, who was out there making his points very strongly. Democrats were sometimes a little frustrated by him. There were some pretty feisty speeches on the floor of the assembly at times over crime in Milwaukee, over racial justice issues that bothered the Democrats at times.
Now, I know he just passed, and maybe it's too soon to talk about the politics here, but what happens now to his seat?
So we would presume that the governor will call a special election for that. Those are usually held with, he hasn't done that yet. Those are held in fairly short order. It's a very Republican seat, so it'll be a Republican who almost surely wins. But, there could be a primary with several people in it, and the primary would likely determine the final occupant of that seat.
And does the redistricting lawsuit we started off talking about play into this at all?
It appears not. The maps for that district and all, and the entire statewide map has been deemed unconstitutional by a lower court, but the Supreme Court has set that aside as it considers considers the case. The experts I've talked to from both sides seem to think that a special election could be held and that that seat can be filled.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
That was Patrick Marley, state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. First, the Trump administration issued a rule today that allows employers to opt out of providing birth control coverage. Officials at the Department of Health and Human Services said the new rule creates an exemption for organizations that have a moral or religious objection to contraception. The new rule is seen as a major blow to the Obama-era contraceptive mandate. The Affordable Care Act required that contraceptives be covered under most insurance plans at no cost to women. It was a controversial policy from the start and got pushback from private companies like Hobby Lobby and religious nonprofits. Danya Palankar is an assistant research professor at Georgetown University's Center on Health Insurance Reform. She joins us now to tell us what the new policy means for women. Danya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, court rulings like the Hobby Lobby case had already kind of chipped away at this contraceptive mandate. What changes now with this new rule from the Trump administration?
Well, this new rule basically is taking what has been a relatively sort of small court decision that applied to a smaller amount of employers and created a process that was different for women of religiously affiliated employers to get health and to get their birth control through their health insurance. And what this does is it changes it from a different process to the women just now don't get their birth control if the employer has either a religious or moral conviction and doesn't want to cover some or all birth control in their employee benefit plan. And it also applies to colleges and universities. So any college or university that does not want to provide that coverage to their employees or their students can also opt out of that such coverage now.
And in announcing this, Trump administration officials had said probably things aren't going to change for that many women in the country. Do you think that's true?
I think it will change for a good number of women. It's a hard situation because we don't know how many people really do have a particularly a moral conviction against birth control. It's not something that exists in any law right now that you can get out of a law and discriminate against a protected class because you are morally opposed to that protection. So we really don't know how broad it will be, but there have already been 100 lawsuits filed, mostly from religious opposition, which suggests that we know there's about almost 100 employers or schools that already oppose, some of which are very big employers, Hobby Lobby being the most famous of the ones, but some very large universities as well. So it's not the type of thing where you will just have a few dozen women affected. You could have the hundreds of thousands of people who work for Catholic hospitals, Catholic universities, as well as some other types of either religiously affiliated or just companies that are run by someone who happens to have this moral or religious belief that happens to have thousands or hundreds of employees that chooses to take this coverage away from their employees.
And you mentioned religious or moral belief, so the standard isn't necessarily if you're from a particular religious background, you just have to express that you, as an employer, have a moral objection to contraception to be able to opt out of this mandate.
That's true. That's exactly what this does. So there's actually two rules, one on religious and one on the moral. And there have been no court cases saying that that an accommodation needs to be worked out or anything for a moral conviction. In fact, if you think about how our laws work in our country, we generally have non-discrimination laws that are meant to protect somebody in the case that someone has a moral conviction. That would somehow hurt them. For example, if someone, you know, if an employer thinks that women should not work outside of the house, we do not allow them to only hire men because of that, because that's sex discrimination. And it doesn't matter that they have a moral conviction against women working outside of the house. It's discriminating against women, and this seems to be opening that door to allow discrimination against women just because an employer has some moral conviction against one type of birth control or the concept of birth control as a whole.
And one response from supporters of this change, I think, is this isn't a big deal. Women can still go out and on their own purchase whatever form of birth control they have. This doesn't restrict their access necessarily.
It restricts access because it takes away the payment for the service. And I think a lot of people may say birth control is not a huge cost, but it first depends on the type of birth control, and second, it depends on what your personal economic situation is. But the long-acting contraceptive methods, which are also the most effective, can cost thousands of dollars to get up front. And even birth control pills, if you're talking, many of them are $70, $75 a month, that's a lot of money for many women. And it may be something that they either can't afford, so they're going to go without, or it's something that their family has to go without something else that might be a necessity. It might actually be another medication because there may be other medications that they can't afford to fill or doctor's visits they can't afford to take if they now have to pay for their birth control.
Danya Palanker is with us from Georgetown University's Center on Health Insurance Reforms, looking at the announcement from the Trump administration today on the contraceptive mandate in the Affordable Care Act, allowing many more companies to opt out. And Danya, as I understood the Hobby Lobby case, Hobby Lobby, I believe, was a family-owned, closely held company, a big one, but still family-held. This expands the exemptions to just about any company, including publicly traded companies. Is that a significant change?
That is. First of all, Hobby Lobby had an accommodation, but their employees were still supposed to be getting the birth control. It just wasn't being provided by Hobby Lobby. There was a third party that stepped in. And this is saying even those privately held corporations like Hobby Lobby don't have to do anything to get that third party participating, so now their employees just don't get it. And for the religious, for those who have a religious conviction against birth control, it includes publicly traded companies. Any employer, any university or college can choose not to. It seems to be a little more restricted for those who have just a moral conviction, but that is really just the large publicly traded corporations that seem to be exempted. So there are some companies that are probably between Hobby Lobby and the publicly traded company that might not be considered closely held under the Supreme Court decision, but that still falls in and can just have that moral conviction, which is such a huge gray area and now such a huge number of employers that can take that exclusion.
One state lawmaker here in Wisconsin had tweeted that this will allow employers not to be forced to provide abortifacients, abortion-causing medications to women, saying that that's been an argument. Some forms of birth control, critics say, are equivalent to a very early-term abortion. What do you think of that response?
Even in the preamble to the rules, they talk about the fact that some employers believe that some forms of birth control are abortificants. And I would say I emphasize the word believe because the science doesn't show that. According to medical science, birth control methods work by preventing the pregnancy from occurring, preventing fertilization of the egg, fertilization and implantation of the egg, and to create a law that allows an employer to exclude a medical service because of a belief that's not actually a scientific belief about how the medicine works, but just how you think the medicine works when it's not actually the case of that medicine is very concerning to me. It's basically letting junk science not just dictate employer decisions, but actually dictating the regulations that are getting written around how employers, have to implement a very important law around women's health care access.
Do you expect to see legal challenges to this decision from the Trump administration?
I expect legal challenges to come very soon. A version of these regulations was leaked months ago, and this isn't actually very different than what was leaked. So I believe there are probably some organizations that have been already preparing, and there are many ways in which these regulations may not stand up in court from just the administrative procedures in how they are issuing rules without an opportunity for people to comment on it, as well as the fact that that anytime you are allowing an employer to limit access to healthcare that only affects women, it definitely raises flags that there is potential for sex discrimination.
The way this was released, is this effective immediately?
It is basically immediately. It's effective this month, and they are going to take people's comments to submit through the federal process for submitting comments. And they said they will be reviewing those comments. But in the meantime, this is actually a final rule, so they become effective.
Danya, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the call.
That's Danya Palenker, assistant research professor at Georgetown University's Center on Health Insurance Reforms. She joined us to look at the Trump administration's new rule that allows employers to opt out of providing birth control in their health insurance plans. It expands opt-out options to the birth control mandate under the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Today is the final day of our series, First Wisconsinites, dispatches from Native American life in Wisconsin today. Today, we're looking at the role of veterans in tribal communities. Kerry Matoxin is manager of the United Nations Veteran Department. He's a member of the United Nations of Wisconsin. Kerry, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Well, talk about the role that veterans play in Native American communities around Wisconsin.
It's pretty interesting. Whenever there's a gathering of a community, a Native community, it's always the veterans that will lead the way to start off the event. So whether if it's a gathering of all the tribal members, a meeting, or at our powwows, which every tribe has.
Yeah, talk about the role they play in powwows, please.
Again, they lead the way in for everybody. It's called the Grand Entry. One of the better ones probably are Indian Summer, which we just had. I think it was Labor Day weekend in Milwaukee. All the tribes have representation, and the vets bring in their Eagle staffs. And we probably had, I think Saturday afternoon, we probably had 12 Eagle staffs out there.
Can you talk about the Eagle staff and the Eagle feather, please?
Eagle staffs, it's just, I shouldn't say just, but it is, each veteran organization will have one. It's like their American flag, if you will, okay? We had those before the American flag. So, they're all different. Every tribe's got a different way that they do a staff. Some have an eagle head on top of it. Some will have deer antlers on theirs on top of it. Then they'll have a streamer of eagle feathers coming down it. Some represent every battle that there's ever been, and they'll have the colors of those battles, ribbons, if you will, military ribbon colors on those. And I know if you go, we have gone to the Ira Hayes days, and Ira Hayes is one of the veterans that raised the American flag at Iwo Jima, and that's in Sacaton, Arizona. And we've taken our staff down there, and different tribes have, and when you partake, then they give you a streamer, so it's kind of like a tribal flag, what can I tell you? It's been all over.
And as I understand it, the eagle feather itself is a very powerful symbol, is that right?
There's a creation story, and you're asking me stuff I got to think off the top of my head here, but the creator story is, that's the highest flying bird that there is. Natives, we can possess eagle feathers. To get that, we have to apply for a permit to the U.S. Wildlife and Game. fishing and gaming, and then you apply for one, just like, you know, it may take 5 years to get what you want, or it may take 6 months, depending. You can ask just for plain feathers, or you can ask for a whole eagle. And then once you get the feather, I got to tell you a quick story.
Sure.
First time I ever got one, I was home on leave. I was stationed in Spain, and I came home on leave, and we had gotten an eagle feather, or an eagle from delivered UPS in a big container of ice. My brother had ordered one, and we knew nothing about it. So this is the first time I've ever dealt with this now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't know what to do with it. So we had a young lady come over and bless that feather, or that eagle. And it was really interesting because there's protocol that's got to be done. You just don't go ahead and start taking stuff off, you know. She burned some tobacco. She dug a hole in by my dad's place and my mom's. And she said some prayers. And once she was done, she did some stuff, buried some stuff in the ground. And she says, now this is yours. You can do what you want to do with it. So it's a formality, you know, that we take spiritually, and I can give a feather out. I'm a veteran. I'm a retired veteran. I did 20 years in the United States Air Force, so I have given out feathers, and again, each tribe has different ways of the way they do things, okay? A good example would be the Ho-Chunk Nation. They have whenever there's a feather dropped, say at a powwow, okay, and they'll have, the Ho-Chunks will have a veteran there to pick up that feather. And when they pick up that feather, there's a ceremony that's done. No pictures are allowed to be taken or anything, no recordings. And when he's all done, whenever the ceremony is all done, he can either keep that feather or he can give it back to the person that dropped the feather. And then that person can do what they want. But the combat veteran that picks up that feather, he must tell his story then, his combat story, so it can become an emotional event for a veteran when it does happen. It don't happen a lot, but when it does happen, it is a spiritual thing then.
We're talking to Kerry Mataxin, manager of the United Nation Veterans Department. According to the Department of Defense, Native Americans have one of the highest representations in the armed forces of the United States. Why do you think that is?
I would probably go back to World War II era, World War I era, okay? We weren't like we are today, okay? There was no plumbing, no electricity on a lot of reservations, probably all the reservations. I'm a young man. I consider myself a young man, but we grew up with no toilet in by my grandparents' house. It was an outhouse and a pump house, no running water inside the house. So it was actually a way to get 3 square meals a day. Okay, good clothing. You know, Uncle Sam's going to give you a good pair of boots and socks, and they're going to take care of you and all this and that. And the Korean and the World War II veterans, they were pretty patriotic people also, because even during World War II, I want to say we weren't citizens of the United States yet, even, but yet there was a huge, you know, everybody signed up for the military, if you will. And so that's always interesting with me. You know, we weren't citizens of the United States, but yet we signed up in groves to defend the United States.
As I understand it, well, you work with helping Native American veterans connect with benefits. As I understand it, after World War II in particular, Native American service members came home, applied for benefits, and then in many cases were rejected, refused benefits. Is that right?
Yes. And what I want to say what happened was, if a veteran goes to the Veterans Affairs, VA, or whoever they went to for their benefit, and they were told no means no. So they never went back. And when I started the job probably 14 years ago, going on 15 years ago, my first customers were the Vietnam vets. But then after you kind of know what you're doing a little bit, we started hitting our Korean and World War II veterans up and finding out that the majority of them did not get their benefits that they were entitled to. And again, the stories I got from some of the World War II vets, and I love these guys. We only have a couple left. They're all in their middle 90s. And when they landed at Normandy, for instance, they walked across Europe all the way. There was no. So these guys were really warriors, if you will. But when they applied for their benefits, they were told no, and they just took that, okay, no means no, I'm not entitled to it.
Has that changed? Partly because of your efforts, are veterans from any era, Native American veterans, getting connected with the benefits that they've earned?
Yes, it is. In Wisconsin, we're making leaps and bounds with our we're called Tribal Veteran Service Officers. By state stature, 72 counties, 72 county veteran service officers. So now we have tribal veteran service officers. And what happened was we had a tribal member that was a claims officer in Milwaukee at the regional office. And he was noticing no Native Americans were getting their benefits. And so he worked with our office. My predecessor was a retired Navy man. He started the first office, if you will, did everything that was needed to be done to get it up and going. And then he retired, and I took the reins. And our staff is 100% accredited with the VA to represent any veteran, not just Native veterans, any veteran. So we attend our training regularly to stay on top of issues. And with the way things are today, that computer in front of you, it's going paperless, and you got to know what you're doing. So,
if there's a veteran listening, Native American or as you say, any veteran listening who is not sure if they're getting the benefits that they've earned, what is your advice to them? How do they get started?
I would recommend that they go to their tribal veteran service officer if they have one, and we only have a couple active in the state, the Ho-Chunk Nation, the Menominee Nation, Lakota Ray, and our office. And the Stockbridge Mohican, they're getting involved now too. And they're all accredited veteran service officers. If you don't have access to a tribal veteran service officer, go to your county. Each county has a county veteran service officer. And they will bring their take your discharge paper with you when you go there. Unfortunately, we had a young guy come to our community, and he asked for help, and we helped him. He said he was a Marine, and some of our veterans put him up in a hotel for a weekend with his family and kids, and come to find out he wasn't a veteran. And so we have to have that DD 214, your discharge paperwork, to verify.
That's all the time we have, Kerry. Thanks so much for coming down and joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Kerry Matoxin, manager of the Oneida Nation's Veteran Department. Coming up, we'll talk to a Native American veteran about his journey from the Army to becoming a tribal liaison in just a minute here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our look at the role of veterans in Native American communities now as part of our series, First Wisconsinites Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today. Sean Stoger is a veteran and a tribal liaison for the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. He's a member of the Lakota tribe. Sean, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about your story in the service. You joined the Army back when you were 18. What led you to join?
I have a strong Native identity. When I was a child, I was born and raised here in Madison. I enjoyed warfare as a kid. Like, that was my favorite game. Some kids play football. So joining the Army was a natural progression. A friend of mine took me into a recruiter's office. I saw all these videos on, airborne Rangers, special forces, and I saw that, and that's what I wanted to do. I scored really high in Army tests, but, so I could have gone in any career field, but that's what I wanted to do.
Or West Point was an option, it sounds like, with your test scores.
Yep, absolutely. Military intelligence, all that stuff.
And talk about your experience in the Army, especially that first term.
My first term, you know, I pushed myself as hard as I possibly could. I excelled. I wanted to go to war. I got my opportunity. It definitely wasn't what I expected. You know, I was really numb during the whole experience. I came back. I had a hard time adapting.
And what happened once your first tour of active duty was over?
I started attending college at the University of Wisconsin. I was really lost, I guess I'd say. You know, my heart was gone. My brain was still in the Army. My body was here on campus. And one day I was in a basement at a party, and I ran into a Native student. She introduced me to the Native community here on campus, and then I started becoming very involved. And that really helped me a lot. I started becoming, I started talking to a lot of clan leaders and elders, and they started helping me, I guess, with the healing process.
A lot of veterans we've talked to and heard about on this show talk about, you know, feeling isolated as they come back to civilian life. They've been through this experience, often traumatic, and they're living among people who haven't been through that and have no clue what it's like to live through that. Was that what you were feeling like?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Native people in general feel very isolated. You know, many Native communities, both in Wisconsin and throughout the country, are very isolated geographically from, you know, urban centers or even highways. And then culturally, you know, like when I came to campus here, I thought I was the only Native on campus. When I was in high school, there were a couple other Native kids. But otherwise, you know, I was very isolated. And then you combine that with the veteran experience, and now you're isolated from being isolated. I mean, you're really out there and very detached from everything.
And talking to Carrie Matoxin earlier, it sounds like Native Americans take their veterans very seriously. Was that something that helped you connect both with civilian life and the Native community?
Yeah, absolutely. I get a little, I think many veterans are that way. You know, someone walks up and thanks you for your service or whatever, and you feel awkward. Mm-hmm. And in Native communities, it's very, people are very appreciative of veterans. And, you know, it's kind of hard for me to take because, you know, for me, it's natural. It's a reflex. It's what's in my DNA. And, you know, it's like thanking someone for breathing. I don't know. I don't know if I answered your question correctly.
Sure. Well, and Carrie talked about, rituals related to veterans at events, at powwows and other events. And it almost seems like the rest of us need those rituals for veterans, because rituals are part of how you go from one state of life to another.
Absolutely. Especially in my work now, you know, I really get to experience how different tribes in Wisconsin handle their veterans. And, you know, having those having those rituals and being able to, I guess, open yourself and express yourself and connect with other people, it really allows for healing.
Talking to Sean Stoger, tribal liaison for the Wisconsin Department of Veteran Affairs, talking about his experience as a veteran and now working with veterans in the state, and talk about how you started to move into working with this state department, working with veterans. Working with other veterans, I should say.
Right. Yeah. You know, basically, I flip-flopped around to a bunch of jobs, mostly in security industry. I was a security contractor for a while with a group that's connected to Triple Canopy out of Chicago. You know, basically flip-flopped around trying to find my way in the universe. I've been in and out of Wisconsin National Guard multiple times. I just got out, actually, for my last time on Monday.
Oh, wow. Okay.
you know, I was looking around. I found this job. I originally had an internship. When I first graduated the university, I had an internship at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And a friend of mine's uncle had my position right now. And so I really liked him. I really liked that job. I thought it was a cool job. And then all of a sudden I saw it pop open. And of course I applied and interviewed, and luckily I landed it.
So what do you do as a tribal liaison for Veterans Affairs?
I actually get to travel around the entire state and interact with all 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. And basically each tribe has a tribal veteran service officer, which is, you know, Carrie Matoxin up in Oneida. each tribe has a person like Kerry, and they help the veterans of their tribe. Each county also has a person like that. It's called a county veteran service officer, but I only help the tribal veteran service officers. And basically, you know, I help them to do their job better. I connect them with benefits, or, you know, if they need a point of contact at the federal VA, or they need someone at the VA hospital to do something, you know, I'm that guy, so...
And how is there a difference between the way tribes work with veterans versus like those county positions?
Absolutely. The one real big difference I notice is, you know, when a like say for example, I live in Sauk County right now, so I walk in and see my county veteran service officer. His name is Louie. I walk in and see Louie, and you know, Louie and I talk and whatever. And when I walk out, you know, that's the last time Louie sees me until the next time I walk in his office. But with a tribal veteran service officer, you know, a veteran walks into, like, say, Kerry's office, interacts with Kerry, and then Kerry goes out, and, you know, that veteran is either related to him or a friend of somebody, or, you know, he sees him wherever, you know, on the reservation. And, you know, Indian country is really small. It's like 1 degree of separation. So if you don't know somebody, you know somebody who knows that person, so...
How much of a difference did it make for you? You mentioned, you know, feeling like you might have been the only Native American at the university and starting to make that connection and getting that 1 degree of separation. How much of a difference did that make in your life?
A tremendous. I don't know if I would have really recovered the first time. But, you know, connecting especially with elders and clan leaders, it really helped me adapt to it, really helped me straighten out my mind and, I don't know, get connected with who I was and what I was and accept myself, you know, forgive myself for a lot of things and accept things I've done, you know.
And that's, you know, I think people think Native American and they think people living on reservations. That's part of the story, but there's this huge diversity. You were in Madison. People are all over, connected in various degrees with the community. That said, do you feel like part of a statewide community among the different tribes and people living in really different situations?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's, like I said, 1 degree of separation, you know. You know, even though there's 11 different tribes, you know, if you don't know somebody, like I go to Oneida and I say, hey, do you know my best friend? Or I go to LCO or Lacouture or LS and I say, hey, I went to college with these guys. And, you know, everybody kind of knows everybody. And they're like, oh, yeah, I, you know, that's my uncle or that's my brother-in-law or whatever. And so there is a huge community, you know, not just myself, but, you know, pretty much all natives in the state, you know. And we travel around. We go to each other's powwows. We go to each other's events. We marry into each other's tribes, you know, so we're all connected.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot for coming up and sharing your story today. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
We've been talking to Sean Stoger, tribal liaison for the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs and a veteran himself. You can hear all the interviews in the First Wisconsin series. Go to WPR.org/first.